This is Audible.
Belinda Audiobooks presents this unabridged recording of The Power of One, written by Bryce Courtney and read by Humphrey Bauer. Be sure to visit our website on www.belinda.com. Details of other available and forthcoming Belinda audiobook releases can be found at the end of this recording.
Hello, I'm Bryce Courtney, and obviously I'm the author of The Power of One, which you're about to listen to. This is a curious book for me because I never expected The Power of One would ever be published. I had heard that when we started to write fiction, that if you were lucky, you got your fourth book published. So I had decided that I would write four books in 5 years, and I'd take exactly 1 year to write the first three, and then the fourth one I'd take 2 years, because that was the one that was going to be published. So I started with The Power of One, and in fact, I didn't really have a story in my head, and I thought, what I'll do is I'll write my own story. What I was really interested in was writing in the first person, because I had to learn that as a technique. So I kind of wrote a super hyped autobiography. So forgive me if I sound rather better than I am, but when you're writing fiction, the hero has to always be bigger than life. And certainly I wasn't PK in that sense, but the narrative is correctly, roughly the story of my life. And I wrote this thing, and it took me, in fact, a year and 17 minutes. And whilst I was writing this, the kitchen door used to bang incessantly. And it was one of those things that you hear in the back of your mind, you never do anything about. And I finally finished The Power of One in a year and 17 minutes, and I thought, thank God it's finished. And I grabbed some string in desperation, tied it up, because the manuscript was 8 inches high. And I was kind of proud of that. I wasn't quite sure it was in it, but I was quite proud that I'd actually achieved my first book in a year. It's never going to be published. I tied it up with a piece of string and used it as a doorstop in the kitchen. You know, to cut a long story short, it worked perfectly until about 4 months later. My eldest son's girlfriend came in one afternoon. There was nobody home, and she kicked the doorstop. And the string must have come undone, and the pages went all over the kitchen floor. And so she desperately started to gather them together, and then she started to read. And 3 hours later, I got home, and she had this pile of paper on her left and a pile of unread paper on her right. And she said, "Mr. Courtney, this is the best book I've ever read." And I said, "Oh, don't be silly. You know, it's a doorstop." And she said, no, please, it's the best book." And I said, "Thank you, darling." And kind of euphemistically patted her on the head. "If you'd be kind enough to wrap it up again, it can remain where it is." Well, to cut a long story short, somebody persuaded to send it to an agent, and I did. And a couple of months later, it was auctioned in New York for $1 million. And that is the story of The Power of One. I do hope you enjoy it.
And now here's your narrator, Humphrey Bauer, with The Power of One.
The Power of One. For Maud Jasmine Greer and Edna Murphy. Here is the book I promised you so long ago. 1. This is what happened. Before my life started properly, I was doing the usual mewling and sucking, which in my case occurred on a pair of huge, soft, black breasts. In the African tradition, I continued to suckle for my first 2.5 years, after which my Zulu wet nurse became my nanny. She was a person made for laughter, warmth, and softness, and she would clasp me to her breasts and stroke my golden curls with a hand so large it seemed to contain my whole head. My hurts were soothed with a song about a brave young warrior hunting a lion, and a women's song about doing the washing down on the big rock beside the river, where at sunset the baboons would come out of the hills to drink. My life proper started at the age of 5, when my mother had her nervous breakdown. I was torn from my lovely black nanny with her big white smile and sent to boarding school. Then began a time of yellow wedges of pumpkin, burnt black and bitter at the edges, mashed potato with glassy lumps, meat aproned with gristle in grey gravy, diced carrots, warm, wet, flatulent cabbage, beds that wet themselves in the morning, and an entirely new sensation called loneliness. I was the youngest child in the school by 2 years, and I spoke only English, the infected tongue that had spread like a plague into the sacred land and contaminated the pure sweet waters of Afrikanerdom. The Boer War had created a great malevolence for the English, for the Rooinekks. It was a hate that had entered their bloodstream and pocked the hearts and minds of the next generation. To their barefoot sons, I was the first live example of the congenital hate they carried for my kind. I spoke the language which had pronounced the sentences that had killed their grandfathers and sent their grandmothers to the world's first concentration camps, where they died like flies from dysentery, malaria, and black water fever. To the bitter Calvinist farmers, the sins of the fathers had been visited upon the sons unto the third generation. I was infected. I had had no previous warning that I was wicked, and it came as a fearful surprise. I was blubbing to myself in the little kid's dormitory when suddenly I was dragged from under my horrid camphor-smelling blanket by 2 11-year-olds and taken to the seniors' dormitory to stand trial before the Council of War. My trial, of course, was a travesty of justice. But then what could I expect? I had been caught deep behind enemy lines, and everyone, even a 5-year-old, knows this means the death sentence. I stood gibbering, unable to understand the language of the stentorian 12-year-old judge, or the reason for the hilarity when sentence was passed. But I guessed the worst. I wasn't quite sure what death was. I knew it was something that happened on the farm, in the slaughterhouse, to pigs and goats, and an occasional heifer. The squeal from the pigs was so awful that I knew it wasn't much of an experience, even for the pigs. And I knew something else for sure. Death wasn't as good as life. Now death was about to happen to me before I could really get the hang of life. Trying hard to hold back my tears, I was dragged off. It must have been a full moon that night because the shower room was bathed in blue light. The stark granite walls of the shower recesses stood sharply angled against the wet cement floor. I had never been in a shower room before, and this place resembled the slaughterhouse on the farm. It even smelt the same, of urine and blue carbolic soap. So I guessed this was where my death would take place. My eyes were a bit swollen from crying, but I could see where the meat hooks were supposed to hang. Each granite slab had a pipe protruding from the wall behind it, with a knob on the end. They would suspend me from one of these, and I would be dead, just like the pigs. I was told to remove my pajamas and to kneel inside the shower recess, facing the wall. I looked directly down into the hole in the floor, where all the blood would drain away. I closed my eyes and said a silent, sobbing prayer. My prayer wasn't to God, but to my nanny. It seemed the more urgent thing to do. When she couldn't solve a problem for me, she'd say, "We must ask Nkosi Nkosikazi, the great medicine man. He will know what to do." Although we never actually called on the services of the great man, it didn't seem to matter. It was comforting to know he was available when needed. But it was too late to get a message through to Nanny, much less have her pass it on. I felt a sudden splash on my neck, and then warm blood trickled over my trembling, naked body across the cold cement floor and into the drain. Funny, I didn't feel dead, but there you go. Who knows what dead feels like? When the judge and his council of war had all pissed on me, they left. After a while it got very quiet, just a drip, drip, drip from some place overhead, and a sniff from me that sounded as though it came from somewhere else. As I had never seen a shower, I didn't know how to turn one on, and so had no way of washing myself. I had always been bathed by my nanny in a tin tub in front of the kitchen stove. I'd stand up and she'd soak me all over, and Dee and Dum, the two kitchen maids who were twins, would giggle behind their hands when she soaped my little acorn. Sometimes it would just stand right up on its own, and everyone would have an extra good giggle. That's how I knew it was special. Just how special, I was soon to find out. I tried to dry myself with my pajamas, which were wet in patches from lying on the floor, and then I put them back on. I didn't bother to do up the buttons because my hands were shaking a lot. I wandered around that big dark place until I found the small kid's dormitory. There I crept under my blanket and came to the end of my first day in life. I am unable to report that the second day of my life was much better than the first. Things started to go wrong from the moment I awoke. Kids surrounded my bed, holding their noses and making loud groaning sounds. Let me tell you something, there was plenty to groan about. I smelt worse than a Kaffir toilet, worse than the pigs at home, worse even than both put together. The kids scattered as a very large person with a smudge of dark hair above her lip entered. It was the same lady who had left me in the dormitory the previous evening. "Good morning, Mevrouw," the kids chorused, each standing stiffly to attention at the foot of his bed. The large person called Mevrouw glared at me. "Come," she said in a fierce voice. Grabbing me by the ear, she twisted me out of the stinking bed and led me back to the slaughterhouse. With her free hand, she removed my unbuttoned pajama jacket and pulled my pants down to my ankles. "Step," she barked. I thought desperately, she's even bigger than Nanny. If she pisses on me, I will surely drown. I stepped out of my pajama pants, and releasing my ear, she pushed me into the shower recess. There was a sudden hissing sound, and needles of icy water drilled into me. If you've never had a shower, or even an unexpected icy cold drenching, it's not too hard to believe that maybe this is death. I had my eyes tightly shut, but the hail of water was remorseless, 1,000 pricks at a time drilling into my skin. How could so much piss possibly come out of one person? Death was as cold as ice. Hell was supposed to be fire and brimstone, and here I was freezing to death. It was very frightening, but like so much lately, quite the opposite to what I had been led to expect.
"When you go to boarding school, you'll sleep in a big room with lots of little friends, so you won't be afraid of the dark anymore."
How exciting it had all sounded. The fierce hissing noise and the deluge of icy piss stopped suddenly. I opened my eyes to find no Mevrouw. Instead, the judge stood before me, his pajama sleeve rolled up, his arm wet where he'd reached in to turn off the shower. Behind him stood the jury and all the smaller kids from my dormitory. As the water cleared from my eyes, I tried to smile gratefully. The judge's wet arm shot out. Grabbing me by the wrist, he jerked me out of the granite recess. The jury formed a ring around me as I stood frightened, my hands cupped over my scrotum. My teeth chattering out of control, a weird glassy syncopation inside my head. The judge reached out again, and taking both my wrists in one large hand, he pulled my hands away and pointed to my tiny acorn.
"Why you piss your bed, Roynick?" he asked. "Hey, look, there is no hat on his snake," someone yelled.
They all crowded closer, delighted at this monstrous find.
"Piscop! Piscop!"
one of the smaller kids shouted, and in a moment all the small kids were chanting it.
"You hear? You pisshead," the judge translated. "Cut the head off your snake, Piscop."
I looked down to where he was pointing, my teeth changing into a quieter timpani. All looked perfectly normal to me, although the tip was a bright blue colour and had almost disappeared into its neat round collar of skin. I looked up at the judge, confused. The judge dropped my arms and, using both his hands, parted his pajama fly. His snake, monstrously large, hung level with my eyes and seemed to be made of a continuous sheath brought down to a point of ragged skin. A few stray hairs grew at its base, and I must say it wasn't much of a sight. More serious trouble lay ahead of me for sure. I was a Roynick and a Piscop. I spoke the wrong language, and now I was obviously made differently. But I was still alive, and in my book, where there's life, there's hope. By the end of the first term, I had reduced my persecution time to no more than an hour a day. I had the art of survival almost down pat, except for one thing. I had become a chronic bedwetter. It is impossible to be a perfect adapter if you leave a wet patch behind you every morning. My day would begin with a bedwetting caning from Mevrouw, after which I would make the tedious journey alone to the showers to wash my rubber sheet. When the blue carbolic soap was rubbed against the stiff cane bristles of the large wooden scrubbing brush I was made to use, fiercely stinging specks of soap would shoot up into my eyes. But I soon worked out that you didn't need the soap, like Mevrouw said. You could give the sheet a good go under the shower and it would be okay. My morning routine did serve a useful purpose. I learnt that crying is a luxury good adapters have to forego. I soon had the school record for being threshed. The judge said so. It was the first time in my life that I owned something that wasn't a positive disadvantage to adaptation. I wasn't just a hated Rinnick and a Piskop. I was also a record holder. I can tell you it felt good. The judge ordered that I only be beaten up a little at a time. A punch here, a flat-hander there, and if I could stop being a Piskop, he'd stop even that. Although he added that for a Rinnick, this was probably impossible. I must confess I was inclined to agree. No amount of resolve on my part, or saying prayers to Nanny, or even to God, seemed to have the least effect. Maybe it had something to do with my defective acorn. I forced a hole in the side pockets of my shorts, through which my forefinger and thumb would fit. I took secretly to pulling my foreskin and holding it over the tip of my acorn as long as I could, in the hope that it would lose elasticity and render me normal. Alas, except for a sore acorn, nothing happened. I was doomed to be a pisshead for the rest of my life. The end of the first term finally came. I was to return home for the May holidays. Home to Nanny, who would listen to my sadness and sleep on her mat at the foot of my bed so the bogeyman couldn't get me. I also intended to inquire whether my mother had stopped breaking down so that I would be allowed to stay home. I rode home joyfully in the dicky seat of Dr. Henny Boshoff's shiny new Chevrolet Coupe. Dr. Henny was a local hero who played fly half for the Northern Transvaal rugby team. When the judge saw who had come to pick me up, he shook me by the hand and promised things would be better next term. It was Dr. Henny who had first told me about the nervous breakdown, and he now confirmed that my mother was coming along nicely, but her nervous breakdown was still with her, and she wouldn't be home just yet. Sadly, this put the kibosh on my chances of staying home and never leaving again until I was as old as my grandpa. Maybe not even then. As we chuffed along in the car, with me in the dicky seat open to the wind and the sunshine, I was no longer a Rinnick and a Piskop, but became a great chief. We passed through African villages where squawking chickens, pumping wings desperately, fled out of the way, and yapping Kaffir dogs, all ribs and snout and brindle markings, gave chase, although only after my speeding throne had safely passed. As a great chief, I was naturally above such common goings-on. Life was good, I can tell you for certain, life was very good. Nanny wept tears that ran down her cheeks and splashed onto her huge warm breasts. She kept rubbing her large dark hand over my shaven head, moaning and groaning as she held me close. I had expected to do all the crying when I got home, but there was no competing with her. It was late summer. The days were filled with song as the field women picked cotton, working their way down the long rows, chatting and singing in perfect harmony, while they plucked the fluffy white fiber heads from the sun-blackened cotton balls. Nanny sent a message to Nkosi Nkosikazi to the effect that we urgently needed to see him on the matter of the child's night water. The message was put on the drums, and in 2 days we heard that the great medicine man would call in a fortnight or so, on his way to visit Mojaji, the great rain queen. The whites of Nanny's eyes would grow big and her cheeks puff out as she talked about the greatness of Nkosi Nkosikazi.
"He will dry your bed with one throw of the shin bones of the great white ox," she promised. "Will he also grow skin over my acorn?" I demanded to know.
She clutched me to her breast, and her answer was lost in the heaving of her belly as she chortled all over me. The problem of the night water was much discussed by the field women, who pondered deeply that a matter so slight could bring the Great One to visit.
"Surely a grass sleeping mat will dry in the morning sun. This is not a matter of proper concern for the greatest medicine man in Africa."
It was all right for them, of course. They didn't have to go back to the judge and Mfro. Almost 2 weeks to the day, Nkosi Nkosikazi arrived in his big black Buick. The car was a symbol of his enormous power and wealth. Even to the Boers, who despised him as the devil incarnate, yet feared him with the superstition of all ignorant, God-fearing men, none was prepared to pit the catechism of the Dutch Reformed Church against this aged black goblin. All that day, the field women brought gifts of food. By late afternoon, a small mountain of Kaffir corn and mealies, gem squash, native spinach and watermelons had grown under the big avocado tree next to the slaughterhouse. Bundles of dried tobacco leaf were stacked up beside it, and separated by 2 large grass ndaba, or meeting mats, lay 6 scrawny Kaffir chickens. These were mostly tough old roosters, four-hour boilers, their legs tied and their wings clipped. They lay on their sides with their thin, featherless necks and bald heads caked with dust. Only an occasional squawk and the sudden opening of a bright, beady eye showed that they were still alive, if not exactly kicking. One especially scrawny old cock with mottled grey feathers looked very much like my grandpa, except for his eyes. My grandpa's eyes were pale blue and somewhat watery, eyes intended for gazing over soft English landscapes, whereas the old cock's were sharp as a bead of red light. My grandpa came down the steps and walked towards the big black Buick. He stopped to kick one of the roosters, for he hated Kaffir chickens almost as much as he hated Shangaans. His pride and joy were his 100 black Orpington hens and 6 giant roosters. The presence of Kaffir chickens in the farmyard, even though trussed and clipped, was like having half a dozen dirty old men present at a ballet class. He greatly admired Nkosi Nkosikazi, who had once cured him of his gallstones.
"I took his foul green mutti, and by golly, the stones blasted out of me like a hail of buckshot. Never a trace of a gallstone since. If you ask me, the old monkey is the best damn doctor in the Lowveld."
We waited for Nkosi Nkosikazi to alight from the Buick. The old medicine man, like Nanny, was a Zulu. It was said that he was the last son of the great Dingaan, the Zulu king who fought both the Boers and the British to a standstill. 2 generations after the Boers had finally defeated his impis at the Battle of Blood River, they remained in awe of him. 2 years after that battle, Dingaan, fleeing from the combined forces of his half-brother Mpande and the Boers, had sought refuge among the Nyerwa people on the summit of the great Lebombo Mountains. On the night he was treacherously assassinated by Nyerwa tribesmen, he had been presented with a young virgin, and the seed of the second greatest of all the warrior kings was planted in her 14-year-old womb.
"Where I chose blood, this last of my sons will choose wisdom. You will call him Nkosi Nkosikazi. He will be a man for all Africa,"
Dingaan had told the frightened Nyerwa maiden. This made the small, wizened black man who was being helped from the rear of the Buick 100 years old. Nkosi Nkosikazi was dressed in a mismatched suit, the jacket brown and shiny with age, the trousers blue pinstripe. He wore a white shirt meant to go with a detachable starched collar. The collarless shirt was secured at the neck with a large golden ivory collar stud. A mangy-looking leopard-skin cloak fell from his shoulders. As was the custom, he wore no shoes, and the soles of his feet were splayed and cracked at the edges. In his right hand he carried a beautifully beaded fly-switch, the symbol of an important chief. I had never seen such an old man. His peppercorn hair was whiter than raw cotton, small tufts of snowy beard sprang from his chin, and only 3 yellow teeth remained in his mouth. He looked at us, and his eyes burnt sharp and clear, like the eyes of the old rooster. Several of the women started keening and were quickly rebuked by the old man.
"Stupid Abafazi! Death does not ride with me in my big mortar. Did you not hear the roar of its great belly?"
Silence fell as my grandpa approached. He briefly welcomed Nkosi Nkosikazi and granted him permission to stay overnight on the farm. The old man nodded, showing none of the customary obsequiousness expected from a Kaffir, and my grandpa seemed to demand none. He simply shook the old man's bony claw and returned to his chair on the stoop. Nanny, who had rubbed earth on her forehead like all the other women, finally spoke.
"Lord, the women have brought food, and we have beer freshly fermented."
Nkosi Nkosikazi ignored her, which I thought was pretty brave of him, and ordered one of the women to untie the cockerels. 2 women ran over, and soon the chickens were loose. They continued to lie there, unsure of their freedom, until the old man raised his fly-switch and waved it over them. With a sudden squawking and flapping of stunted wings, all but one rose and dashed helter-skelter, their long legs rising high off the ground as they ran towards open territory. The old cock, who looked like Grandpa, rose slowly, stretched his neck, flapped the bits of wing he had left, his head darting left and right, slightly cocked as though he were listening. Then, calm as you like, he walked over to the heap of corn and started pecking away.
"Catch the feather devils!"
Nkosi and Kozikazi suddenly commanded. He giggled.
Catch an old man's dinner tonight!
With squeals of delight, the chickens were rounded up again. The ice had been broken as five of the women, each holding a chicken upside down by the legs, waited for the old man's instructions. Nkosi and Kozikazi squatted down and with his finger traced a circle about 2 feet in diameter in the dust. He hopped around like an ancient chimpanzee, completing 5 similar-sized circles, muttering to himself as he did so. The incantation's over. He signaled for one of the women to bring over a cockerel. Grabbing the old bird by its long, scrawny neck and by both legs, he retraced the first circle on the ground, this time using the bird's beak as a marker. Then he laid the cockerel inside the circle, where it lay unmoving, its eyes closed, a leg protruding from each wing. He proceeded to do the same thing to the other 5 chickens until each lay in its own circle in front of the crowd. As each chicken was laid to rest, there would be a gasp of amazement from the women. It was pretty low-grade magic, but it served well enough to get things underway. Nkosi and Nkosikazi moved over and squatted cross-legged in the center of the Indaba mat and beckoned that I should join him. It was the first time he'd acknowledged my presence, and I clung fearfully to Nanny's skirts. She pushed me gently towards him and in a loud whisper said,
"You must go. It is a great honor. Only a chief can sit with a chief on the meeting mat."
He had the strong, distinctly sweet smell of African sweat, mixed with tobacco and very old man. After all I'd been through in the smell department, it wasn't too bad, and I too sat cross-legged beside him, with my eyes glued to the ground in front of me. Nkosi Nkosikazi leant slightly towards me and spoke in Zulu.
"Tomorrow I will show you the trick of the chickens. It's not really magic, you know. These stupid Shangans think it's magic, but they don't deserve to know any better." "Thank you, sir," I said softly. I was pleased at the notion of sharing a secret.
Even if it was only a trick, it was a damn clever one which might confound the judge and the jury if I could get my hands on a stray chicken at school. My confidence in his ability to change my status as a piscop was growing by the minute. Nkosi Nkosikazi indicated to Nanny that she should begin the matter of the night water. 2 women were quickly delegated to start the cooking fire, and the rest of the field women settled down around the Indaba mats, taking care not to touch even the tiniest part of the edge. African stories are long, with every detail cherished, scooped up for telling 1,000 times over. It was a great moment for Nanny, as she stood alone in the rapidly fading twilight and told her story. She spoke in Shangaan so that all could share wide-eyed and groan and nod and sigh in the appropriate places. The hugeness of Mefro with her moustache they found amazing, the injustice of the judge and jury they took in their stride, for they all knew how the white man passes sentences that have no relationship to what has been done. The pissing upon me by the judge and jury had them rocking and moaning and holding their hands to their ears. Such an indignity was surely beyond even the white man. In the sudden way of Africa, it was dark now. A piece of green wood crackled sharply in the fire, sending up a shower of sparks. The leaping flames lit Nanny's face. There was no doubt that they would remember this teller of a great story of misery and woe. Tears flowed copiously as she told of how death finally arrived in a shower of icy piss that jetted from the loins of the great moustached angel of perdition. I must admit I was hugely impressed, but when Nanny got to the part where my snake had no hat, which, in my opinion, was the most important bit of the lot, they cupped their hands over their mouths, and between the tears they started to giggle. Nanny concluded by saying that the business of my night water was an evil spell brought upon me by the angel of death with the moustache like a man and waterfall loins, so that she could return each morning to feed her great beating shambok on my frail child's flesh. Only a great medicine man, such as Nkosi Nkosikazi, could defeat this evil spell. The light from the fire showed the deeply shocked faces of the women, as Nanny finally sat down, heaving with great sobs, knowing that such a tale had never been told before, and that it might live forever, warped into a Shangaan legend. I can tell you one thing. I was mighty impressed that any person, most of all me, could go through such a harrowing experience. Nkosi Nkosikazi rose, scratched his bum and yawned. With the handle of his fly switch, he prodded my weeping nanny.
"Get me some kaffir beer, woman," he demanded.
Dee and Dum, the twin kitchen maids, served me my dinner, as Nanny was required to attend to the drinking and other needs of the scrawny old wizard. Both little girls were wide-eyed with the excitement of it all, and told me I was the bravest person they had ever known. By bedtime, Nanny was at my side as usual, arriving with a large sweet potato, its tummy open with a spoon sticking out of the middle, tiny wisps of steam curling upwards, condensing on the handle. There's something about a sweet potato that cheers you up when you're low and celebrates with you when you're happy. Sweet potatoes baked in their jackets have a very large comfort factor built into them. Nanny's excitement was still with her. She grabbed me and crushed me to her enormous bosom and laughed and told me how I had thrust greatness upon her with the coming of the old monkey, who was nevertheless the greatest medicine man in all Africa. How the telling of the tale of the night water showed that a Zulu woman could be a teller of tales superior in every way to even the best told by the most eloquent Shangaan. I pointed out that she had entirely missed the matter of my school record for canings. A large tear rolled down her cheek.
"In the matter of white man's punishment, the black people already understand that the body can be broken by a shambok, but never the spirit. We are the earth. That is why we are the color of earth. In the end, it is the earth who will win. Every Afrikaan knows this."
Whatever all that was supposed to mean, it didn't answer my question. Nanny finally left me, but first she lit the paraffin lamp and turned it down low, but not so low that I wouldn't recognize the bogeyman should he try to sneak into my room.
"Tonight, Nkosi Nkosikazi will visit in your dreams, to find the way of your night water," she said, tucking me in.
The morning after, the night Nkosi Nkosikazi went walkabout in my dreams, he summoned me to sit alone with him again on the meeting mat. From an old leather bag, he produced the 12 magic shin bones from the great white ox. Then, squatting on his haunches, as he prepared to throw the bones, he commenced a deep, rumbling incantation that sounded like distant thunder. The strange bone-yellow dice which would solve my bedwetting habit briefly clicked together in his hands and then fell onto the ground in front of him. Nkosi Nkosikazi flicked at them with his forefinger, and as he did so, tiny rolls of thunder came from his throat. With a final grunt, he gathered them up and tossed them back into his ancient leather satchel. Nkosi Nkosikazi's eyes, sharp pins of light in his incredibly wrinkled face, seemed to look right into me.
"I visited you in your dreams, and we came to a place of 3 waterfalls and 10 stones across the river. The shinbones of the great white ox say I must take you back so that you can jump the 3 waterfalls and cross the river, stepping from stone to stone without falling into the rushing torrent. If you can do this, then the unfortunate business of the night water will be over."
I nodded, not knowing what to say. After all, 5-year-old kids are pretty rotten at riddles. His face became even more simian as he chuckled.
"When you have learned this lesson, I will show you the trick of the chicken sleep."
I had seen the faint marks of last night's circles, but no chickens. I guessed that they had been consigned to the communal tummy. "I only hope he doesn't use one of Grandpa's black Orphingtons. What a kerfuffle that would be," I thought.
"Now, listen to me carefully, boy. Watch and listen. Watch and listen," he repeated. "When I tell you to close your eyes, you will do so. Do you understand?"
Anxious to please him, I shut my eyes tightly.
"Not now. Only when I tell you. Not tight, but as you do when your eyes are heavy from the long day, and it is time to sleep."
I opened my eyes to see him crouched directly in front of me, his beautiful fly switch suspended slightly above my normal sight line. The fall of horsehair swayed gently before my eyes.
"Watch the tail of the horse."
My eyes followed the switch as it moved to and fro.
It is time to close your eyes, but not your ears. You must listen well, for the roaring of water is great.
A sudden roar of water filled my head, and then I saw the three waterfalls. I was standing on an outcrop of rock directly above the highest one. Far below me, the river rushed away, tumbling and boiling into a narrow gorge. Just before the water entered the gorge and churned white, I noted the 10 stepping stones, like 10 anthracite teeth, strung across its mouth. Nkosi Nkosikazi spoke to me, his voice soft, almost gentle.
It is late. The bush doves, anticipating nightfall, are already silent. It is the time of day when the white waters roar most mightily, as water does when it is cast in shadow. You are standing on a rock above the highest waterfall, a young warrior who has killed his first lion and is worthy now to fight in the Legion of Dingaan, the great impi that destroys all before it. Worthy even to fight in the impi of Shaka, the greatest warrior king of all. You are wearing the skirt of lion tail as you face into the setting sun. Now the sun has passed beyond Zululand, even past the land of the Swazi, and now it leaves the Shangaan and the royal kraal of Mojaji, the rain queen, to be cooled in the great dark water beyond. You can see the moon rising over Africa, and you are at peace with the night, unafraid of the great demon Skokian, who comes to feed on the dark night, tearing its black flesh until at last it is finished, and a new light comes to stir the sleeping herd boys and send them out to mind the lowing cattle.
As I stood on the great rock, waiting to jump, I could see the new moon rising, bright as a new florin above the thundering falls.
You must take a deep breath and say the number 3 to yourself as you leap. Then, when you surface, you must take another breath and say the number 2 as you are washed across the rim of the second waterfall. Then again a deep breath as you rise and are carried over the third. Now you must swim to the first stone, counting backwards from 10 to 1, counting each stone as you leap from it to the next to cross the rushing river.
The old medicine man paused long enough for me to work out the sequence he had given me.
You must jump now, little warrior of the king.
I took a deep breath and launched myself into the night. The cool air, mixed with spray, rushed past my face, and then I hit the water below, sank briefly, rose to the surface, and expelled the deep breath I had taken. With scarcely enough time to take a second breath, I was swept over the second waterfall, and then again I fell down the third roaring cascade, to be plunged into a deep pool at the base of the third waterfall. I swam strongly and with great confidence to the first of the great stones, glistening black and wet in the moonlight. Jumping from stone to stone, I crossed the river, counting down from 10 to 1, then leaping to the pebbly beach on the far side. Clear as an echo, his voice cut through the roar of the falls.
We have crossed the night water to the other side, and it is done. You must open your eyes now, little warrior.
Nkosi Nkosikazi brought me back from the dream time, and I looked around, a little surprised to see the familiar farmyard about me.
When you need me, you may come to the night country, and I will be waiting. I will always be there in the place of the 3 waterfalls and the 10 stones across the river.
Pointing to what appeared to be an empty mealy meal sack, he said,
Bring me that chicken, and I will show you the trick of the chicken sleep.
I got up and walked over to the sack and opened it. Inside, the sharp, beady red eye of the chicken that looked like Grandpa blinked up at me. I dragged the sack over to where the previous circles he'd made in the dust had been, and the old man rose and called over to me to draw a new circle in the dirt. Then he showed me how to hold the old rooster. This was done by securing the main body of the chicken under your right armpit like a set of bagpipes, and grabbing it high up its neck with your left hand so that its featherless head is held between forefinger and thumb. Getting a good hold of its feet with your free hand, you dip the chicken towards the ground at an angle of 45 degrees, while squatting on the ground with the chicken's beak not quite touching the rim of the circle. The beak is then traced around the perimeter 3 times, whereupon the bird is laid inside the circle. The old man made me practice it 3 times. To my amazement and his amusement, the old rooster lay within the circle, docile as a sow in warm mud. To bring the chicken back from wherever chickens go in such trying circumstances, all I needed to do was touch it and say in a gruff voice, "Chicken sleep, chicken wake. If chicken not wake, then chicken be ate." Which is, I suppose, a pretty grim warning to a chicken. I did not ask Nkosi Nkosikazi how a Shangaan chicken could understand Zulu, simply because you do not ask such questions of the greatest medicine man in all of Africa. I was as yet unaware that this chicken was pretty exceptional, but the ability to understand a couple of African languages was probably not beyond him.
"The chicken trick is our bond. We are now brothers, bound in this common knowledge, and also the knowledge of the place of the dream time. Only you and I can do this trick, or come to that place."
I'm telling you something, it was pretty solemn stuff. With a yell across the farmyard, the old man called for his driver, who was asleep in the back of the Buick. Together we walked towards the big black car.
"You may keep this chicken to practice on,"
Nkosi Nkosikazi said as he climbed into the back seat of the car. As if from nowhere, the car was surrounded by field women who loaded up the trunk with the tributes they'd brought the previous day. Nanny handed the old man a small square of brightly colored cloth, into the corner of which were knotted several coins. Nkosi Nkosikazi declined the offer of what was, for Nanny, 2 months' salary.
"It is a matter between me and the boy. This place is on my way to Molototsi River, where I go to see Mojaji, the Rain Queen."
He stuck his head out of the rear door window and gazed up into the sky.
"The rains have not come to Zululand, and in this matter, her magic is greater than mine."
The rains had been good north of the Drakensberg Mountains, and now Nanny grew fearful as she asked for news of her people.
"The fields are ploughed 3 months, and the seed maize is ready in the great seed pots, but the wind carries away the soil as we wait for the rains to come."
The old man sighed. Nanny translated the news of the drought to the women. Drought is always news to be shared among the tribes. The women broke into a lament, doing a shuffling dance around the Buick and singing about the Great One who brought the rains, gave barren women the sons they craved, and cured the bite of snakes, even of the great black mamba. Nkosi Nkosikazi stuck his ancient head out of the window again and shook his fly switch impatiently.
"Begone with you, you stupid old crows. Sing for Mojaji, the rain queen. This old rainmaker has failed to squeeze a drop from the sky."
With a roar of its mighty V8 engine, the big black automobile shot down the road, raising a cloud of dust behind it. By the time the holidays were over, Grandpa Chook, for that was what I had called my chicken gift, and I were practically inseparable. Calling a chicken a chook was a private joke my mother and I had shared. We had received a bunch of photos from a distant cousin in Australia, one of which had shown a small boy not much older than me feeding the chickens. On the back of the photo was written, "Young Lenny feeding the chooks on the farm in Wagga Wagga." We had called the two old drakes who always quacked around the farmyard together Wagga Wagga, and had started referring to Grandpa's black Orpingtons as the chooks. Grandpa Chook was, I decided, a splendid name for this scraggy old rooster who came running the moment I appeared at the kitchen door. There was no doubt about it, that chicken had fallen for me. I don't mind admitting I felt pretty powerfully attracted to him as well. We practiced the chicken trick for a couple of days, but he got so smart that the moment I drew a circle in the dust, he stepped into it and settled down politely. I think he was only trying to be cooperative, but it meant I had lost all my power. Grandpa Chook was the first living creature over which I held power, and now this not-so-dumb cluck had found a way of getting back on even terms, which was demmed annoying, if you ask me. 2. The holidays came to an end. My bedwetting habit had, of course, been cured, but not my apprehension at the prospect of returning to boarding school. As for my hatless snake, I'd asked Nkosi Nkosikazi about that, and he'd hinted that we were similarly unique, which was why we were so special. It was comforting at the time, but now I wasn't so sure. Nanny and I had a good old weep on the last evening at home. She packed my khaki shorts and shirts and two pairs of pajamas and a bright red jumper my mother had sent from the nervous breakdown place. We laughed and laughed, in between crying, of course, because one sleeve was about 10 inches shorter than the other. Nervous breakdowns probably do that sort of thing to people's knitting. By unpicking it at the shoulders, Nanny made it into a nice red jumper. We set out after breakfast in Grandpa's old Model A Ford truck. On the way we picked up fat Mrs. Forster, the widow who owned the farm next door. Grandpa spoke no Afrikaans and she no English, so she thumped up and down in silence with her chin squashing onto her chest with every bump of the old truck. I was delighted to be in the back with Nanny and Grandpa Chook, who was concealed in the mealy sack, where he lay so still you'd have sworn he was an empty sack. Nanny was going to town to send money to her family in Zululand to help with the terrible drought. Grandpa Chook's wing feathers had practically grown again, and by taking a run-up, his long legs pumping up and down, he could take off and land high up on a branch any time he liked. I have to admit, while he was heavier, he wasn't any prettier. His long neck was still bare, and his head still bald. His coxcomb was battered and hung like an empty scrotum to one side of his head. Compared to the black Orpingtons, he was a mess. We stopped at the school gates, and Nanny handed me the suitcase and the bag with Grandpa Chook playing possum.
"What have you got in the bag, son?"
Grandpa asked.
Before I could reply, Nanny called from the back, "It is only sweet potatoes, Bas."
The tears were as usual running down her cheeks, and I wanted to rush back and hide myself in her big safe arms. With a bit of backfire and a puff of blue exhaust smoke, the truck lurched away, and I was left standing at the gate. Ahead of me lay the dreaded Mithro, the judge and the jury, and the beginning of the power of one, where I would learn that in each of us there is a flame that must never be allowed to go out, that as long as it burns within us, we cannot be destroyed. I released Grandpa Chook from the sack and gave him a pat. Puskop the Rinnak, possessor of a hatless snake, was back in town. But this time, for damn sure, he was not alone. The playground was empty as we crossed it. Grandpa Chook darted here and there after the tiny green grasshoppers that landed on its hot, dusty surface. They too seemed to be in enemy territory, for not a blade of grass grew on the sun-baked square of earth. To make it across to safety, they were forced to land frequently, exposing themselves to the dangers of a marauding Grandpa Chook. Though the odds were rather better for them, there were hundreds of them and only one Grandpa Chook, while it was the other way round with the two of us. We seemed to have arrived early, so I made for my secret mango tree, which grew on the other side of the playground. Leaving my suitcase at its base, I climbed into its dark, comforting canopy of leaves. Grandpa Chook, taking a run-up and flapping his wings furiously, flew up and perched on a branch beside me, swaying and wobbling and making a lot of unnecessary noise and fuss. I carefully explained the situation to him. He just sat there and tossed his silly coxcomb and squawked a lot. I tried to impress on him that this was the big time, that things were different here to down on the farm. I must say that any chicken who could outsmart Nkosi Nkosikazi's cooking pot and get the better of his magic circle had to be a real professional, so I didn't lecture him too much. Grandpa Chook was a survivor. How fortunate I was to have him as my friend. After a while we left the mango tree, and skirting the edge of the playground we made our way to the side of the hostel, which contained the small kids' dormitory. It looked out onto a run-down citrus orchard of old, almost leafless grapefruit trees. Half a dozen cassia trees had seeded themselves over the years, and their bright yellow blossom brought the dying orchard back to life. The ground was covered with khaki weed and blackjack, which reached to my shoulder. No one ever came here. It was the ideal place for Grandpa Chook to stay while I reported to Mifro. Deep inside the orchard, I set about making a small clearing among the rank-smelling weed, and in the process unearthed a large white cutworm with a grey head and a yellow band around its neck. Grandpa Chook thought all his crispuses had come at once, and with a sharp squawk he had the plump grub in his beak. You could see the progress of that worm as it made a bulge going down his long, naked neck. The clearing complete, I drew a circle on the ground, and he settled politely down into it. It still annoyed me a bit that he refused to go through the whole magic rigmarole, but what's the use? You can't go arguing with a chicken, can you? I found Fro in the washhouse, folding blankets. She looked at me with distaste, and pointed to a tin bucket which stood beside the mangle. "Your rubber sheet is in that bucket. Take it," she said. I tried not to sound scared. I am cured, Mifro, I stammered.
Huh. Your opa's beating are better than mine then, yeah?
I stood with my head bowed, the way you are supposed to be in the presence of Mifro.
No, Mifro, your beatings are the best. Better than my grandpa's. It just happened. I just stopped doing it.
My shambok will be lonely.
Mifro always called the bamboo cane she carried her shambok. She handed me a coarse towel and a blanket.
You are too early. There is no lunch. The other children will be here not till this afternoon.
The blanket smelt of camphor balls, and with the familiar smell the old fear returned, and with it came doubt that perhaps I wasn't cured of my bedwetting habit. I dropped my blanket and towel off in the small kids' dormitory and returned to Grandpa Chook. The absence of lunch didn't bother me. Nanny had packed two large sweet potatoes in my suitcase, and I now planned to share one of these with Grandpa Chook. As I approached the abandoned orchard, I could hear a fearful squawking coming from Grandpa Chook. Suddenly he rose from above the weeds, his short wings beating the air. I lost sight of him again as he plunged back into the undergrowth. Up he came again, neck arched, legs stretched with talons wide. Down again, the weeds shaking wildly where he landed. This time he didn't come up, and he had stopped squawking, though the khaki weed continued to shake where he'd disappeared. My heart beat wildly. Something had got Grandpa Chook, a weasel or a feral cat. It was my fault. I'd left him helpless in the magic circle. I stumbled blindly towards the tiny clearing where I'd left him, khaki weed and Black Jack lashing out at me, holding me back. Grandpa Chook stood inside the circle. Held firmly in his beak was a 3-foot grass snake. With a vigorous shake of his head and a snip of his powerful beak, he removed the head from the snake and, to my astonishment, swallowed it. The snake's head went down in the same way as the fat cutworm had done. Unaware that the show was over, the snake's brilliant green body continued to wriggle wildly in the weeds. The toughest damn chicken in the whole world tossed his head and gave me a beady wink. I could see he was pretty pleased with himself. I'll tell you something, I don't blame him. How can you go wrong with a friend like him at your side? The snake had ceased to wriggle, and picking it up, I hung it from a branch of acacia tree growing only a few feet from the window nearest my bed in the little kid's dormitory. Now there were two hatless snakes in the world, and I was involved with both of them. The afternoon gradually filled with the cacophony of returning kids. I could hear them as they dumped their blankets and suitcases in the dormitory and rushed out to play. Grandpa Chook and I spent the afternoon making his shelter from bits of corrugated iron I found among the weeds. He seemed to like his new home, scratching for worms where I'd pulled up the weeds. He would be safe and dry when it rained. By the time the wash-up bell went at 4:45, I was a bit of a mess from all the weeding and building. I left Grandpa Chook for the night, scratching happily away in his new home, and washed under a little used tap on the side of the building facing the orchard. By the time the supper bell went, the late afternoon sun had dried me, and I was as good as new. I waited until the last possible moment before slipping into the dining hall to take my place at the bottom table where the little kids sat. Shortly after lights out that night, I was summoned to appear before the judge and the jury. It was a full moon again, just like the very first time, but also a moon like the one that rose above the waterfalls in the dream time, when, as a young warrior, I had conquered my fears. The judge, seated cross-legged on a bed, was even bigger than I remembered. He wore only pajama pants, and now sported a crude tattoo high up on his left arm. Cicatrization wasn't new to me. African women do it to their faces all the time, though I had not seen a tattoo on white skin before. Reddish-pink skin still puckered along the edges of the crude blue lines, which crossed at the center like two headless snakes wriggling across each other. Absently rubbing his tattoo, the judge shook his head slowly as he looked at me.
"You are a fool. A bloody fool to have come back, Piscop."
A small lump of snot in his left nostril pumped up and down as he breathed. "You have marks like a Kaffir woman on your arm," I heard myself saying. The judge's eyes seemed to pop out of his head. He snorted in amazement, and the snolly bomb shot out of his nostril and landed on my face. His hand followed a split second later. I felt an explosion in my head as I was knocked to the floor. I got to my feet. Stars, just like in the comic books, were dancing in a red sky in front of my eyes, and there was a ringing noise in my ears. But I wasn't crying. I cursed my stupidity. The holidays had blunted my sense of survival. Adapt, blend, become part of the landscape, develop a camouflage, be a rock or a leaf or a stick insect, try in every way to be an Afrikaner. The jury was silent, struck dumb by my audacity. A warm trickle of blood ran from my nose, across my lips and down my chin. The judge grabbed me by the front of my pajamas and pulled me up to his face, lifting me so that I stood on the very tips of my toes.
"This sign means death and destruction to all Roynicks, and you, Piscop, are going to be the first."
He released me, and I stumbled backwards, but managed to stay on my feet.
"Yes, sir," I said, my voice barely audible. "This is a swastika, man. Do you know what that is?"
No, sir.
"God has sent us this sign from Adolf Hitler, who will deliver the Afrikaner people from the hated English."
I could see the jury was deeply impressed, and I was too. The judge turned to address the jury, prodding at the swastika.
"We must all swear a blood oath to Adolf Hitler," he said solemnly.
The jury crowded around his bed, their eyes shining with excitement.
"I will swear too,"
I said hopefully. The blood was still running from my nose, and some had dripped on the floor.
"Don't be fucking stupid, Piscop, you are the English."
The judge stood upright on the bed and held his arm aloft at an angle, with his fingers straight and pointing to the ceiling.
"In the name of Adolf Hitler, we will march every Roynick bastard into the sea."
I had never been to the sea, but I knew it would be a long march, all right.
"The blood oath, the blood oath," the jury chanted. "Come here, Piscop," the judge commanded.
I stepped over to his bed.
"Look up, man."
I looked up at him as he stood high above me on the bed. He wiped his forefinger under my nose, and then he pushed me so that I sat down hard on the floor. He held up his finger, my blood on its tip shining in the moonlight.
"We will swear this oath with the blood of a Roynick," he announced solemnly.
Two members of the jury lifted me to my feet while the others crowded around me, sticking their pudgy fingers into the blood running from my nose. The supply wasn't coming fast enough, and one boy tweaked my nose to increase the flow. This seemed to cause it to stop altogether, so that the last two members were forced to dab their fingers into the drops of blood on the floor. The judge, wiping the blood on his finger across the swastika, instructed the jury to do the same. Soon the swastika on his arm was almost totally concealed.
"Death to all Englishmen in South Africa, the fatherland!"
the judge cried, raising his arm once more.
"Death to all Englishmen in South Africa, the fatherland!"
the jury chorused. The judge looked down at me.
"We won't kill you tonight, Piscop. But when Hitler comes, your days are numbered, you hear?"
"Yes, sir, when will that be, sir?" I asked.
"Soon."
He stepped from the bed, and placing his huge hand over the top of my head, he turned me towards the dormitory door and gave me a swift kick up the bum, which sent me sprawling headlong across the polished floor. I could smell the wax polish on the floorboards, and then I got to my feet and ran. Back in my own dormitory, the little kids leapt out of bed, crowding around me, demanding to know what had happened. Too upset to mind my tongue, I sniffed out the story of the swastika and the blood oath, and my threatened demise upon the arrival of Hitler. An 8-year-old named Dani Kutzia shook his head solemnly.
Puskop, you're in deep shit, man, he said. Who's this person called Adolf Hitler is coming to get Puskop?
A fellow we called